Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from The James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. It's week two of nonstop Les Wexner news, and we're going to start the roundtable with this developing story. Ohio State is fielding hundreds of calls to remove Les Wexner's name from campus buildings amid growing anger over his ties to sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. A new term, Wexit, has been coined by groups pushing for the removal, and nurses at Ohio State yesterday picketed outside the just-opened $2 billion medical tower that is a part of the hospital system that bears Wexner's name. These actions follow Wexner's testimony last week in front of a U.S. House Oversight Committee of Democratic lawmakers. No Republican lawmakers traveled to New Albany to attend the deposition. Here to catch us up on the latest news, we have WOSU reporter George Shilcock. Thanks again for coming on, George.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Let's listen to a little bit of sound from what you covered yesterday.
Wexner equals pay! Remove the name! Wexner equals pay! Remove the name!
So you were there yesterday, Sunday, when Ohio State nurses and members of the nurses' union had what they called an informational picket. And this was on the opening day of the newest building of the university's medical complex. So tell me more about what the nurses are saying there.
Yeah. So they have joined a growing chorus of people saying that Les Wexner's name should be removed from buildings on campus. Mm-hmm. That includes the entire medical center system mm-hmm. for the Wexner Medical Center, the Les Wexner football complex, and other sites as well. Mm-hmm.
So they came out because this giant tower was having its official grand opening yesterday. So that's why they chose to do it yesterday. Was there any response from the university or the hospital system?
The university sent me a statement that, of course, you know, they respect people's right to gather and stuff like that. But then they reminded everyone that for renaming buildings, it goes through a process with the university where it goes through an official renaming committee that they have. And that people should be going through that for the proper way to get a building renamed.
Yeah, President Carter, President Ted Carter of Ohio State, was on All Sides, and he told me and other media outlets that they were waiting to see the outcome of the testimony, waiting to see what happened. There's a process in place, as you just mentioned. But there is this steady and rapidly growing chorus of voices who want some changes. I mean, they're even... I heard that they were taping over some W's on campus.
Oh, yeah. And university employees also got umbrellas in the mail for the Wexner Medical Center celebrating mm-hmm. the new opening of this hospital tower. And some of these nurses showed up with those umbrellas and X'd out Wexner's name on it. Mm. You mentioned the Wexit thing, a nod to Brexit, the whole
yes, thing. Ohio State students made up a new word. Yes, yes.
People had hats that said Wexit on it, too, as well.
Now, you reported that Ohio State doesn't actually have contracts tying Wexner's name to these donations. That's something people were wondering, if the name went away, if the money would go away, too.
So what we did was we sent a public records request to the university asking for any contracts or agreements that govern the naming of the Wexner Medical Center, the Wexner Center for the Arts, which is actually named for Les Wexner's father, and the football complex as mm-hmm. well. And what we found was, I was told there are no such contracts for the mm-hmm. medical center or the football complex. That's actually just governed by a honorary resolution that the Board of Trustees did saying, hey, we're going to name these after you. And the Center for the Arts, which again was named for his father, does have one of those agreements, but not really any money tied to it per mm-hmm. se. There is just stipulations saying that, hey, if by 1997 you haven't given us this money, or if you've died, we will recoup that.
97 is a long time ago. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been decades since that really went away. But yeah, there's nothing saying that if this is renamed, that all of the $200 million that Les mm-hmm. Wexner has given to the university over the years will be taken away.
Okay. So it's not like a contract. It's more of like a good faith. Because Wexner went to Ohio State, you know, served on the board. Like, it was a good faith resolution where the board said, thank you for all this money. Here's your reward. Here's your name up there.
Yeah, yeah. You can think of it like that.
Okay.
For sure.
So let's get to the congressional testimony a little bit, because we're going to talk about, there's been other elected officials around the state weighing in on all of this, but, and we'll get to that later with the other reporters in the roundtable. But I wanted to get to the congressional testimony that you covered. The L Brands founder answered questions from House Oversight Committee members for 5 hours. Who they all came to New Albany for the deposition, and there were Republican staffers there, but no actual GOP lawmakers. Do we know why?
That's a great question. They did not send any explanations. We even asked the Ohio Congress people who are on that committee why they didn't come, both the Democrat and the two Republicans, Jim Jordan, Mike Turner, and then Democrat Chantel Brown, did not make the short trip to New Albany.
Right.
From their
Congress
districts.
Wasn't in session, so they weren't in, they didn't have to be in D.C.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was told by Chantel Brown she had a scheduling conflict, but Jim Jordan never answered me. And Mike Turner, his website restricts you contacting his office by a zip code filter. So.
Oh, you have to live in the district to contact him?
Yep.
Oh, OK. Well, so the testimony was just before Democratic staff members then. But this committee that is doing these depositions is huge, isn't it? Like 40 some people, right?
It's a lot. Yes.
Okay.
And
so
we have five Democrats showed up.
Okay. So five came here. You listened to the testimony because reporters weren't allowed in the room, but 2 days after the testimony, they sent the file and you could watch the whole thing. He testified for 5 hours. Before I play a little bit of audio from it, what was your overall impression of the testimony?
5 hours is a lot to sit through. but no, I think what really struck me was just the amount of times that Les Wexner said he couldn't recall details, and the fact that he never pled the fifth. He never said, hey, I'm not going to answer this question because it might self-incriminate me. Those are really what struck me. And just he, throughout the testimony, when he did recall things, would almost harken back to the same statement that he thought Jeffrey Epstein was a con man, a notorious con man, that he was diabolical and that he was very smart and he was getting away with all these things. And it astounded Les Wexner.
He did use the word astound.
No. He used the word appalled.
Appalled. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. There are two pieces of audio of Wexner testifying that I have here. And in the second piece, you're going to hear from a congressional aide who's asking the question. Let's listen.
As I look back at it, I was conned by the World Olympic all-time con artist. And you look at, I read in the news all the people he knew, royalty, kings, princes, and all that. An incredible con artist.
Did you ever witness Mr. Epstein have sexual contact of any kind with young women or girls?
Absolutely not.
Did you ever witness Mr. Epstein sexually abuse young women or girls?
Absolutely not.
There was another part in the deposition where Wexner denied having a personal friendship with Epstein. He said it was completely all business. What did you make of that part of the testimony?
What I made of it was the fact that the staffers and the Congress members then followed up on that plenty of times and pointed out, hey, you signed his birthday book and you wrote your friend Leslie. Mm-hmm. He showed up to birthday parties of yours. He showed up to your personal boat launch in Germany. How is he not your friend? And Les Wexner would say stuff like, oh, well, I was friendly with him. I wasn't his friend, kind of like how I am with my attorneys.
Mm, okay. Yeah. So and there is evidence to refute that, though. I mean, there's evidence that.
We have a photo of him with his arm around Jeffrey Epstein with champagne glasses in their hand. They look pretty friendly. They're laughing together. That was at the boat launch that I mentioned.
Right. But he is saying he's a con artist and Epstein did steal a lot of money from Wexner.
Allegedly,
we know that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Allegedly, that's what Les Wexner alleges, that they found out that he stole vast sums of money, like hundreds of millions of dollars from him.
And congressional Democrats said that Wexner gave Epstein, at one point they said he gave him $1 billion, but Wexner's attorneys came out disputing that number. There's a dispute about the using the term $1 billion.
Yeah, and the Columbus Dispatch reported last week that the House Democrat who said that, Robert Garcia, the ranking member, misspoke.
Okay.
On that. So there was a moment during the deposition where they were trying to determine what Epstein's income was from Wexner, what his supposed to be income was, not what he stole. And they went over the fact that he handled about $1 billion worth of stock. And I guess I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he may have heard that and thought, oh, wow, Epstein stole over $1 billion.
Well, he had act- or
that
he
was
had
the only time $1 billion came up.
OK, got it. And how did Wexner's attorney, who was sitting next to him throughout this entire deposition, how was he advising him during the testimony? Because there was an exchange that was caught on video.
Yeah, there was a pretty viral exchange that it was. After 4 hours of testimony, this viral moment on the internet showed up where he leans over to Wexner as he's telling he's on a tangent and says essentially, if you say more than five words, I will effing kill you. it was quite a moment. But I do want to note that. That wasn't the first time he did that. Mm. He just didn't do it so bluntly. It was around like the 2 hour mark that Wexner was again on another tangent, telling a longer story. And Michael Levy, that's the attorney's name, leaned over. Just like, hey, can you not talk? Can you like say less? Not in like a way of like, hey, like you're saying too much. You could incriminate yourself more. It came across to me as he was saying, you keep telling these long stories. Can you
use fewer words, please?
Yeah, can we not make this 5 hours?
Which it was. So, all right. You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This is our weekly reporter roundtable, and we are talking with WOSU reporter George Shilcock about Les Wexner's testimony last week in the Epstein case. And George, you were at a press conference that you mentioned. The Democrats, about halfway through the testimony, came out and had a press conference in the middle of the deposition. And all of them expressed doubt about Wexner's denials. Here is California Congressman David Minn.
He has basically alleged that he saw no evil, heard no evil, despite being in the room with Jeffrey Epstein over and over and over. And it's really just not credible.
And here is Congressman Robert Garcia, also of California, talking about the question, the questions that all of this raises, not just for the country, but also closer to home.
Today's not the end of our questions for Mr. Wexner. It's the beginning of our questions for Mr. Wexner and anyone in this community across Ohio or the country that has done business dealings or that knows why he provided so much money for Jeffrey Epstein to then go on and commit all these horrible crimes. And so I think this community has questions of Mr. Wexner. Ohio State should have questions of Mr. Wexner.
So what do you make of those comments? Because basically, Congressman Garcia was saying that Ohio State, Columbus, like we should care more.
I think going to Dave Minn and something that he said, he mentioned how, and this was purposeful, how when he got off the plane and he drove to New Albany, he noticed multiple buildings on the route with Wexner's name over it. And I think they were pointing out to people that, hey, Les Wexner has such an impact on Columbus. And as he faces all this scrutiny, people should be paying attention to this. They may not know that, you know, we have been paying attention to it. This has been one of the biggest stories of this year so far in the Columbus area. But yeah, and I think it goes to their main point of, you may have heard it there a little bit, but they're really trying to hone in on Wexner's money and how that may have enabled Jeffrey Epstein, whether he stole it or not. It's that position being managing all that wealth and allegedly stealing it is what they are kind of focusing on, what they want to look into more.
Yeah. Well, before I let you go, we'll end with one final cut from Congressman Garcia, which underlines the financial significance here.
There would be no Epstein Island. There'd be no Epstein plane. There'd be no money to traffic women and girls. Mr. Epstein would not be the wealthy man he was without the support of Les Wexner.
Do you think that's a fair statement? Would Epstein not have been able to have everything he had without Wexner?
I mean, it's been well noted throughout Epstein's career that Les Wexner was his biggest client. We don't know really who his other clients were, to be fair. But this is a billionaire. And whether he stole the money or not, that money is largely what helped Epstein grow into what he became.
And so, George, just to end on, what happens next? You know, this deposition happened here in New Albany. Does anything happen next? Do we know?
Well, there are continued calls here at OSU to take down Wexner's name. That's something we're watching. We don't know what law enforcement in the Capitol is going to be doing about this. I mean, Les Wexner was named as a co-conspirator for the 2019 sex trafficking investigation, but he was never charged with any crime. Mm-hmm. We don't know what further is going to come of this. If the House Democrats do look more into his finances, what Republicans think of doing about it, it's just all something to watch.
Yeah,
for sure.
And as the congressman said, that this was the beginning, not the end. So we'll see if there's more testimony even. Who knows? Yeah. We've been talking about Les Wexner's deposition to members of Congress and his association with Ohio State with WOSU News reporter George Shilcock. Thank you for your time today, George.
Thank you, Amy.
Coming up, the governor and state lawmakers are weighing in on Wexner as well. That is when the reporter roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. This is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We're going to start our regular roundtable today. Joining us, we have Joe Engels, senior reporter with the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Joe.
Great to be here.
Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Laura.
Good morning.
And Signal Ohio reporter Jake Zuckerman. Welcome back, Jake.
Thank you for having me on.
And we've been talking about the testimony of Les Wexner, and now we're going to get some insights from our Statehouse reporters about the state officials who have been weighing in. Governor Mike DeWine was at a governor's summit in Washington last week, and he made a comment to Politico that he didn't think Wexner's name should come down from any Ohio State buildings. DeWine said there's no evidence that Wexner did anything wrong. He hasn't been charged with a crime. He called Wexner's relationship to Epstein a, quote, an old story. Joe, what did you make of DeWine making those comments?
Well, he's right. There haven't been any charges filed. And so that makes it, you know, very difficult. I mean, you know, Les Wexner wrote a statement of his own the day that he did the deposition. And he said, I'm a victim here, guys. I'm a victim. I was, you know, I got taken by him. And, you know, as soon as I found out what was going on, I cut ties and, you know, that kind of thing. You know, that's the way he continually painted himself during this deposition, that he was the victim. He kept, you know, kind of distancing himself. Oh, you know, we weren't friends. He was very careful to say, you know, that they had a business relationship. But I think, you know, a lot of people have questioned that relationship because Epstein had, you know, basically the equivalent of power of attorney over a whole lot of Wexner's money. And I think a lot of people say, you know, why does this person have so much control if you're not friends with them? That's a kind of a foreign concept. So but the governor definitely has a point that there haven't been any charges filed.
Yeah, Laura, this idea of DeWine calling it an old story and saying that Ohio State doesn't need to take his name down for everything, is this in line with Governor DeWine's more cautious approach on controversial topics? What do you think?
Well, yeah, it's definitely on brand for Mike DeWine. I thought it was a little bit out of step, though, given that there's this steady drumbeat that seems to be getting louder for more scrutiny of Les Wexner's ties to Jeffrey Epstein and how that reflects on the university. So yes, it is an old story. We've known about these ties for a long time, but I think the revelation and the disclosure of all these documents, as well as the deposition, this disconnect of Les Wexner saying, "I was conned, I was naive, I'm the victim," at the same time when he was running a multi-million-dollar retail giant, mm-hmm. seems there's something doesn't fit together here.
Right. To not be being conned on one side, but also being like really successful on the other mm-hmm. side. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I think that the governor, he is very cautious, and he is correct. There are no charges. But I think that saying it's an old story kind of doesn't pay heed to the fact that there's a lot more attention on it right now.
Yeah. Joe, state lawmakers have had a range of reactions, because you wrote about Republican State Senator Andrew Brenner has been using the hashtag Wexner Out on his social media this past week, and he's calling for Wexner to no longer serve on any boards. Here's some audio you had.
I think he should step down now. I'm not calling on his name to be removed from anything. I'm not saying he's guilty of anything, but I think the distraction in general has become too big for Ohio State.
So, Joe Brenner, how do you think he came to this conclusion? Is he really just focusing in on the distraction?
Well, he said that he talked with some of the victims of the controversy with Dr. Strauss, mm-hmm. which is a different controversy altogether, but the same thing. It has a lot of the same through lines on it. And he said that, after talking with victims, after looking into more information about the situation, he just feels like this controversy has been too much of a pall on Ohio State, mm-hmm. and that they need to, kind of get Les Wexner off all the boards, off all the committees. Now, he didn't call for his name to be removed, mm-hmm. but there are some who have.
Yeah. And you also talked with Democratic Senator Bill DeMora, who also connected it to the Dr. Strauss sexual abuse case. Here's what he said.
We are still fighting stuff from the 70s and 80s, that if we got rid of it, it wouldn't be an issue anymore. If we just settled, Ohio State's got the money. It's time to settle with these athletes. It's time to get rid of Les Wexner's name. It's time to get rid of the board of trustees that are tied to Les Wexner and clean up our university.
Jake, what do you make of these twin controversies and its impact on Ohio State's reputation right now?
Yeah, I mean, obviously not great. Mm-hmm. There's just this through line here that Joe, I think, was hinting at, that the university isn't acting like a five-alarm fire when there are scaled instances of sex abuse permeating. And true or false, I mean, it's a damning thing to have floating around in the news. I think one thing I'd want to add about the mm-hmm. DeWine conversation is it's obviously true that Les Wexner was never charged, but so much of the Epstein story was about these people not getting charged. That was a through, with these files that have come out, police were investigating Jeffrey Epstein. Donald Trump himself was apparently calling the Palm Beach police and saying, "The guy's a creep, you should look into it," and the charges never came. So usually we look at something like the absence of criminal charges as something close to a statement of non-guilt with an issue, and I just don't know that lens is so reliable. I mean, everything about the Jeffrey Epstein story sort of shakes up our faith in that basic lens that if they haven't been charged, they probably didn't do it.
And in with everything, it's always about the money. And Republican U.S. Senator John Husted last week became the latest high-profile Ohio politician to donate campaign funds that he received from Wexner. So they're not per se giving it back. They're donating it to other places. He joined many others, Congresswoman Joyce Beatty among them. Governor DeWine received considerable campaign donations from Wexner. In those comments that he made where he said this was an old story, did he say what he plans to do with the money? Does anyone know?
Well, his campaign is over. I mean, he
unlike, oh, that's true. He's not. Yeah,
he's not running for anything. So he's not really in the same position as the others who are giving back campaign funds. So no, but he didn't, to my knowledge, didn't say anything about that.
Yeah, Jake.
And if I could add, I have not covered the Wexner story especially closely, but I've covered the First Energy scandal, which your listeners are familiar with. And for years, there was this steady trickle of new information, some of which was unflattering for Mike DeWine. and there was a regular pattern of asking Mike DeWine about, you know, email X or text message X or testimony X, and Mike DeWine would say some variation of the same thing. This is an old story. It's time to move on. Whether or not this information is new, the story is old. So I think it's a pretty familiar defensive tactic.
You know, the funny thing, Amy, is I've noticed that, you know, when people from outside Ohio look at our scandals here in Ohio, and it doesn't matter which one it is, you know, pick one. It plays different outside of Ohio than it does inside Ohio. We notice that there's all these documentaries on HBO or Netflix or, you know, name the whatever it is. And, you know, outside Ohio, people watch those and they have a lot of interest in them. I don't know how many Ohioans have actually watched those and how many Ohioans actually express any interest in the subject.
Hmm. I was just going to add one thing. You know, Andy Brenner saying that it's time for Les Wexner to step off boards. He's the chair of the Medical Center Board. Mm-hmm. You know, Les Wexner is 88 years old, and I would think that the Medical Center would have some sort of a transition plan in place. And I don't know if there's been any discussions about going ahead and, you know, hitting the button on the transition.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Or at least to a board member emeritus status of some sort, yeah. Senate President Rob McCauley got about $5,000 from Wexner in 2024, and he told your colleague, the State House News Bureau reporter Sarah Donaldson, quote, "Every senator can make their own decision." And then he said this.
"I've never met the guy. I don't know the guy. I don't even know how to get a hold of him, even if I wanted to. So, you know, but at the same time, I think every member should do what they feel is in their own conscience to do under this circumstance."
So he is the running mate of GOP candidate Vivek Ramaswamy. And I don't know if, did he tell Sarah what he's going to do with his $5,000?
I don't think so. I don't know.
Yeah. And then House Speaker Matt Huffman also had an interesting reply. So Sarah Donaldson asked him about $20,000 that he received from Wexner between 2021 and 2022. And here's that exchange.
"Are you going to return donations? And have you advised any of your caucus members to return donations from him?"
"I'm pretty sure I'm not allowed to talk about campaigns and politics inside the state capitol. So you'll have to catch me in a restaurant in downtown Lima sometime."
So that was an interesting way to dodge the question, I thought. Jake, what do you make of that way that Huffman answered that question? I mean, he talks about things all the time. Why do you have to go to a Lima restaurant to talk about that?
I don't know. I can't give campaign and elections, politics, ethics, et cetera, advice here. But I'm not sure exactly who that complaint would come from. You know, who's going to be shaking on the doors saying, "How dare you talk about a refund?" I don't actually understand where the trouble would be coming from. He could also leave the State House and answer the question. He has political people who could send Sarah an answer if he wanted to.
Yeah. What did Sarah say to you whenever she asked him that, and that was his answer?
Well, you know, that day we were so busy, I don't think we really had a discussion about it. But I think it is curious. And he also spoke, Huffman also spoke later in the day, because there were two gaggles, we call them, with reporters, where you can just shoot questions at leaders. And in the second one, Huffman, you know, basically said the same thing, but he kind of acted like he didn't know who he was, really. You know, he kind of gave this, I don't know.
Know who Wexner was?
Yeah. Hmm. He's like, "Les? Les Wexner?"
Was he being funny?
I don't know. I didn't know how to read it, quite honestly. So.
Hmm. Well, just to end on before we move on from Les Wexner, Joe, you spoke to Ohio State political scientist emeritus Paul Beck about this, just how this might impact midterm elections, politics in Ohio. You know, there's a lot of moving parts here, money involved, a lot of opinions. What was Paul Beck's analysis?
Well, you know, he said if there are charges coming out, if that could make a big difference. If people start getting charged and people start, you know, noticing that can make a big difference. But, you know, basically people, he said in Ohio, there's a lot of, you know, pox on all their houses, that people consider politicians, not to be honest, all politicians, and they, you know, all these people who have a lot of money, that there's always a suspect kind of way of looking at things. So this isn't as jarring. So he said, really, it's going to depend a lot about whether there's charges and how it plays out in the future.
All right. Does anyone want to add anything else, or you want to leave Wexner alone for now?
Oh, I don't understand if there's charges, unless there's like the candidate is charged with something. I don't see Les Wexner and the Jeffrey Epstein thing having any kind of impact on Ohio politics.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. You've been listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This is the Reporter Roundtable. We're talking with Laura Bischoff with the Columbus Dispatch, and Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Jake Zuckerman from Signal Ohio. So turning to other Statehouse news, Laura, a judge ordered the immediate removal of the board chairman of the State Teachers Retirement System, known as STRS. This is the second largest pension plan in the state. So catch us up. Why is the board chairman being removed?
This has been an ongoing saga at STRS, which is the Teachers Retirement Fund. They have about $100 billion invested on behalf of 500,000 teachers and retirees. It's governed by an 11-member board, which is like a combo of political appointees who are financial experts and people who are either active teachers or retired teachers who are elected by the membership. Mm-hmm. Rudy Fichtenbaum has been the chair of STRS for a while. He's an elected retiree member. He was a professor of economics at Wright State University. And he teamed up with, there's like a faction on the board. There's like the ones who want to see a return to the cost of living allowance that had been interrupted for a good stretch of time, and that really upset a lot of the retirees. They were also upset because the investment staff was still being paid performance bonuses even when the performance was subpar, like they were losing money. But they said, well, we lost less money than our benchmarks, so we should still give the bonuses. So there's been all of this turmoil at that system, and there's a faction on the board, some that are calling themselves reformers and then more the status quo. And this has led to just a lot of drama. And there was a company called QED that wanted to pitch to STRS to, use some new investment strategy. And the STRS management said, no, you don't have a track record. You don't have a bunch of money under management. You're not quite ready. No, thank you. And QED didn't take no for an answer, so it started working with Rudy Fichtenbaum and another board member at the time, Wade Steen, to try to pitch this project. And when that didn't go well, then there was like a campaign to change the membership of the board and elect more reformers who would be more open to all of this. So that's the backstory.
Yeah. So what happened is,
there's a lot of stuff that happened, but it resulted in the attorney general saying that Wade Steen and Rudy Fichtenbaum violated their fiduciary responsibility, which is like you're on the board and your responsibility to act in the best interest of the pension system and nothing else. And filed a lawsuit. It went to a Franklin County Common Pleas Court Judge Karen Held Phipps. They had a five-day trial at the end of October, and she issued a ruling last week that said, yes, they violated their fiduciary responsibility because they acted as agents for QED. And it did all this damage to the system, reputational damage, some costs for special audits, et cetera. And that even though they were acting toward the laudable goal of restoring the COLA, that you can't just do by any means necessary to do so. And she also dinged the board, saying it didn't do enough to the board collectively didn't do enough to kind of say, hey, let's pump the brakes here. This is harming our system, all of this turmoil and discord.
So the judge making this ruling, is it a criminal charge, or do they just get removed from the board? Like, what's the consequence here?
It was a civil case, and they're getting removed. Wade Steen was already off the board. His term expired. And then Rudy is supposed to be immediately removed. And then both of them would be barred from serving on the STRS board again.
Okay. Seems obvious. Like, okay.
Right. This is an appealable order. Mm-hmm. But I haven't had any contact from Fichtenbaumer or Steen about what their next step is.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sure they had attorneys and they haven't made a comment on whether they're going to appeal it, I guess.
Yeah. And I'm not even sure who's paying the fees for their legal side. Mm-hmm. They had been covered by the Ohio Retirement for Teachers Association. Mm-hmm. But then the Ohio Ethics Commission last month issued a directive, an opinion, saying you can't have an outside group that has business pending before your agency pay your civil legal fees. There was already an opinion on the books, mm-hmm, saying you can't do it for criminal, now civil. So Orta should not be paying for their civil expenses. And then also, having just done a story on the First Energy paying the legal fees for the guys who are on trial, I have to check, but I think STRS may also be obligated to pay the legal fees for Fichtenbaum and Steen because, you know,
acting as a board member. Right. Interesting.
And I don't know if that would extend to an appeal as well.
Yeah. And this has been an ongoing thing for a long time. I mean, STRS has been involved in this for a while. This is not like even a new case.
It's a multi-year extravaganza.
All right. Well, we are going to talk about the First Energy trial because I want to get an update on that. And we're going to talk about a few energy-related items coming up in just a moment when the Reporter Roundtable continues from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. This is the weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And with me, we have from Signal Ohio, reporter Jake Zuckerman, Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter at the Columbus Dispatch, and Joe Ingles, a senior reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Jake, you wrote about the Trump administration's plans to give about $175 million to 6 coal plants, and 2 of those are here in Ohio. One's in Steubenville, I think, and this is for modernization purposes. So what's the plan with the money, and why are we trying to modernize these coal plants?
Yeah, well, I put modernization in quotes. I think you did, too, with your fingers there.
I did. Well, not on the radio, but yes, modernizing coal plants, yes.
It's important to understand, like, the OVEC plant, which is in southeast Ohio, this is from it was built in 1952. I don't know what exactly you can do to, quote-unquote, modernize the plant.
Anything would modernize it, right?
Yeah. Sure, okay, fair point. But that said, yeah, like you mentioned, this money is coming to, quote, modernize the plants. I think usually that means put the kinds of scrubbers on there and other things to limit the amount of carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide and some of the other nasty crud that they emit into the planet. But I think the big tell here, or the two big through lines here that I'd point out, are, for one, the OVEC plant has a very long history of Ohio taxpayers propping it up. From about 2014 to 2025, Ohioans spent $700 million, you know, huge, huge sum of money through their electric bills paying to support those plants because they just kept losing money. They cannot compete with nuclear, gas, solar, et cetera. Hmm. I believe that's less true at the Cardinal plants, the ones in Steubenville. But in any event, you know, this coal is by and large the way of the past. Most of the modern world is getting away from it. And this money is not only coming from the Trump administration, but they have reappropriated the money in what was otherwise passed for energy efficiency, home weatherization. So this money was sort of supposed to make us less dependent on the grid, less dependent on fossil fuels. And instead, it is being redirected to these coal plants that, A, keep losing money, and B, are, just because of their age, really, really pollutive. They're very dirty plants.
Hmm. All right. Well, we'll see. We'll see where we go from there with the coal plants, because the administration continues to say they're not going to invest in wind, solar, the clean energy ideas. Correct?
Yeah. Yes, that is correct.
All right. Well, while we're talking on energy, I wanted to pivot because Laura mentioned it briefly. There is the first energy trial is going on in Akron. And if one of the two of you or both of you, Laura, Jake, if you want to give us an update, how are prosecutors building their case against the former executives? This is Chuck Jones and Mike Dowling. They're on trial in Akron. Do you want to start?
Yeah, right, I'll start with that one. I've had my nose pretty close to the screen on that one. So far we've had, I mean, the interesting thing is there are a lot of former First Energy employees, many of whom have received immunity deals, so they can speak a little more candidly, perhaps. Mm. We've heard from two company lawyers. Let's see, a company lobbyist is testifying today. And they're all, most of the prosecutor's focus has been on the origins of First Energy's financial relationship with Sam Randazzo, which goes to about 2013, maybe even before that, depending how you count these things. And then into how what started as this strange quasi-consulting legal backroom and nobody knows exactly what was said between the parties relationship turned into a $4.3 million payment. And that payment was sent just about 4 weeks before Sam Randazzo was actually appointed by Governor Mike DeWine to lead the PUCO. So
is that payment? Are we allowed to call it a bribe, or is that
it is alleged to be a bribe?
Okay,
I'd say the really interesting here is the prosecutors are saying, like, look, this money is a bribe. They gave it to Sam Randazzo. He becomes the chairman of the PUCO. As the chairman of the PUCO, he does all these regulatory favors and legislative actions that make a bunch of money for First Energy. Pretty simple. Sam Randazzo died by suicide in 2024, so mm-hmm. we will not hear his side of events. But the defense lawyers are saying, no, this wasn't a bribe. This was a legitimate payment of a settlement, and you got to bear with me here. This was a settlement agreement from 2015. That legal settlement was from a PUCO case, and that settlement was, and I quote, bolted on to Sam Randazzo's consulting contract. The $4.3 million was the termination of the out years, so that was 29 through 2024, of that contract. So basically, they're blaming what is now a dead man, and they're saying, we didn't bribe him. That money was intended for his clients. He stole that money. How could it have been a bribe if we didn't know where it was going? And the prosecution are trying to point out a lot of irregularities in this financial relationship. For instance, most lawyers, if they get a settlement for their clients, they put that money in an IOLTA. I don't know what that stands for, but it's a special trust account. They can't even keep the interest. There are all these rules. You know, it's someone else's money. So there are all these rules about how professionals are supposed to handle it. First Energy paid this money to the Sustainability Funding Alliance of Ohio, I believe is the acronym. It is an LLC that basically only existed on papers. It had no employees. Sam Randazzo was its sole owner. The settlement agreement came in the form of a consulting contract. These First Energy employees are all testifying that they didn't know about it. Some are saying, oh, I thought it was a settlement agreement we had with them. I thought it was a consulting contract. So there's all this irregularity and seeming whiffs of impropriety. One lawyer in the company, I can't actually use the phrase on air, but bull crud. Bull crud is as safe as I feel.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for that. And Laura, I saw you had a story about how there's 20 attorneys in the room for this trial. Is First Energy on the hook for all these legal fees? Why do we need 20 attorneys?
I don't know why they need 20, but they have about 20 attorneys on the docket. I think there were 18 or 19 of them present that our Akron Beacon Journal reporter counted, did a nose count. If you serve on a board, oftentimes you'll have what's called an indemnification agreement so that your actions while serving in good faith on the board, the company will cover your legal expenses if you're under investigation or subpoenaed or on trial or what have you. Mm. And it extends past, even if you're fired, the indemnification continues. And so that's what's happening now. And of the 20 attorneys that are listed, a lot of them are from Baker Hostetler, which is a pretty big firm, Tucker Ellis, a couple of people from Chicago, Washington, D.C., and New York. And I think 15 of them are partners in these big law firms. Mm-hmm. And I've checked with a couple of different sources. They charge, anywhere from $1,500 to more than $2,000 an hour. So even if you just do 40 hours a week times a 10-week trial times 15 partners and not even count the other five attorneys who are in on this, as well as the people who might be in the background doing, you know, research and other stuff, and you're not counting the hours that they're putting in after trial closes for the day or any kind of weekend stuff. I mean, we're talking, it's going to be at least $7 million.
Wow.
Just for the Summit County case. And now keep in mind also that, you know, they've faced stuff in regulatory, like before the PUCO, the FEC, the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, the FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. That's the regulatory side of stuff. Then they also have, you know, lawsuits pending in federal court. They're facing criminal charges, Jones and Dowling. And then there's these massive shareholder lawsuits that are pending. Most of them got rolled together and before Judge Marbley in U.S. District Court here in Columbus. But, like, I checked the docket on Marbley's, on the case before Marbley, and it's like 973 entries.
Oh.
So there are battalions of attorneys who are taking depositions, pouring through millions of pages of documents.
Wow.
Yeah, it's
huge.
It's going to be way, okay. the bill is going to be way more than $7 million.
Understood. Jake, this trial that's happening right now in Akron, is it a jury trial? Is it a judge trial? Like, just a judge?
It is a jury trial.
It's a
joint trial of Charles Jones and Mike Dowling.
Okay. And are they like streaming it, or do you have to be up in Akron in the courtroom to hear it?
It is streaming on Zoom. Anyone can just Google Susan Baker Ross, the judge's website, and you can find a link. You can sit in yourself.
Okay. So this is, you know, one of the many cases that Laura just mentioned. I mean, do we have any idea how long this trial will go on? Are we a few days into it?
The estimate was 8 to 10 weeks, and it started
weeks.
At the end
oh.
of January. And I can tell you, it's not going as fast as anyone wanted. What I would say, my analysis personally, and having talked to some other attorneys who are watching this, is that the defense is using boredom as a weapon, because part of their argument is, you know, the state's spin in this big yard and bribery and $4.3 million and all that splash and dash and razzle dazzle, but they're trying to say this was business. These PUCO cases are, and they're correct, they are extremely complicated. I mean, you're talking about a grid that covers 13 states. You need to have supply that perfectly matches demand. So you need to have generation, transmission, distribution to customer. You know, it's a very complicated space inherently. And I think that they're really drawing out some of these details. Some of these cross-examinations can take hours, and they're like watching paint dry. So I think that there's an incentive from the defense bar and the 18. I mean, my last count was 18. Apparently, I've missed two lawyers, or two more have been added to the gang somewhere along the way. But just really make this whole thing hurt. And I'd add here that on the First Energy side, they are clearly splitting the load. You know, different lawyers handling objections, handling examination of different witnesses. So far, there have been maybe 9 witnesses, and all but one fairly minor witness have been handled by Matt Meyer, the assistant Ohio Attorney General. So he's like a one-man band competing against like 9 law firms from 4 cities with 6 partners each.
Wow. And I'm trying to feel some empathy for the jurors. 8 to 10 weeks? Wow.
Yeah, and I don't believe you're actually guaranteed pay, your salary for jury service. So, I mean, like personally, I can't handle a quarter of the year without income. So I salute to them for doing their constitutional duty. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, the federal trial in Cincinnati against Householder and Borges was 7 weeks. And I felt like the jurors were sort of dropped into this world of Ohio politics and energy policy and bank records. And it was a lot of really, I mean, I thought it was going to be like a lot more razzle dazzle. And I was stunned at how boring a lot of it was.
Wow. Like, because, you know, bribery, you're like, oh, okay, let's talk about these backroom deals.
But yeah, and you're like, oh, okay, finally we're going to hear from the FBI guy, sure. Yeah. And Blaine Wetzel gets up there, and he just tries to make it as mundane and as boring and technical as possible.
And they literally, I mean, like, you read a tweet thread or a text thread, and you could read it in 30 seconds, not even 30 seconds, and they will take an hour to come analyze every word and have someone read every word out loud into the record. It can be quite painstaking.
Well, we're down to a minute left, so I guess I just will ask each of you, you know, what you're covering this week, what's going on, because we only have a minute left, and that's about all we have time for. What are you covering this week?
Someone else has to go first.
Well, I assume we're probably going to have more Wexner Epstein related stuff coming at us this week. And so that I probably will be covering that, and who knows what else.
Yeah. Laura, you have anything on your docket or just the first energy trial?
You know, a little bit of this and that. I'll probably circle back with STRS and try and nail down, you know, how are the legal fees being paid?
Mm. All right. And did you come up with something, Jake? Or
the first energy trial.
Yeah.
You're going to out here.
Because it's so thrilling.
It's very
right?
cumbersome. It's very onerous.
All right. You've been listening to the Weekly Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. Jake Zuckerman from Signal Ohio, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me on.
Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
And also Joe Ingles, senior reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, Amy.
And you're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Turovich.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.